And welcome back. This is Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Craig Colley. Craig's interesting background includes an honours science degree and a Bachelor of Laws. He's a TV producer-director by background and was head of TV production at SBS. Now he is an author, having written the highly acclaimed books The Path of Infinite Sorrow and Nagasaki and The Codebreakers. Now Craig is the author of a new book called On Our Doorstep, When Australia Faced the Threat of Invasion by the Japanese. Craig, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Thank you, Bill. Good day.
So, Craig, this book began as the story of the 97 air attacks on the Australian mainland in World War II, which was, even that's probably a surprise to a lot of people these days. But what drew you to the broader story of the Japanese threat?
Amongst other things, 97 air raids, although that fact is quite extraordinary, and the first air raid is particularly extraordinary, namely the one on Darwin. 97 of them in a book would start to get a bit repetitive, so I needed to flesh it out. And in sort of looking at what was happening, it occurred to me that what was interesting was the expectation of being invaded and occupied by Japan, the extent to which that consumed Australians, by which I mean the people, the military, the government, and what they were doing about it. So the story evolved into the preoccupation with the possibility of invasion. Putting aside how realistic that was, I looked at it for the bulk of the book at what we were seeing from Australia. We don't have access, or we didn't have access then, to Japan's plan, so we were just looking at the evidence and what prompted the belief that we were a target.
Yes, I'm sure it was very real for the people in Australia, but
absolutely.
You make some interesting observations about one of the Australian heroes, John Curtin, and he said, as you put on the cover of your book, "I can't understand the mentality of the Australian people. One day they are in a panic about the war, and the next day they want to go to more race meetings." Do you think John Curtin was in fact a bit of a wowser?
Well, he's said to be a wowser, but not to labour the point. He is not. He was a wowser in that he was fairly abstemious in his habits, but according to the reports of people then, he didn't make a big deal about it and carry on about it. He let people lead their own lives, if you like. But that particular quote isn't so much wowserism, it's frustration, and reflects the change in the perspective that I had. I went into this story thinking there was constant panic about the possibility of being invaded. Everyone was obsessed with that because that's what you read about. And I think people, when they were being spoken to about how did you feel, they felt that's what they ought to say. They sort of thought that was what they were thinking at the time because that seems to be the logical one. But the more I read, the more, and this is very Australian, I think, switched between sort of almost extreme panic and thinking, well, she'll be right, don't worry, it always works out. And that's the thing that frustrated Curtin, I think, that he couldn't get a sort of constant response, concern about this possibility. It was only occasional when something cropped up that prompted it. Otherwise, there was the sort of underlying belief that somehow we'll get through. I guess that was vindicated in the end. We did.
Yeah, we did, fortunately.
So it was a frustration of trying to run a government and in a war and trying to mobilise the public, particularly towards the austerity that was necessary, whether the invasion was going to happen or not. We were fighting a war, first of all, in Europe and then on our own doorstep. And that means making sacrifices of comforts and various other things.
Now, John Curtin said Australia was at war with Japan after Pearl Harbor on 7 December 1941. Was that because the threat of the Japanese to Western interests came, I suppose, into focus more?
Certainly there wasn't Harbour wasn't perceived as a particularly great threat to us. Japan was generally. The expectation had been that the Japanese were likely to invade the Philippines, not Hawaii. As it turns out, they invaded both of them on the same day, which was thought to be beyond the capacity of the Japanese. So certainly when they pushed in our direction, starting with Malaya, Malaya probably wasn't such a concern because we'd been sold the belief that Singapore was an impregnable fortress. But certainly when Singapore fell, that was suddenly looking like, why were they coming this way and what else was their target apart from Australia? Well, their target was, in fact, the oil fields of what's now Indonesia, then Dutch East Indies, and beyond that, they just wanted to secure their perimeter. So their interest in New Guinea was not so much as a stepping stone to Australia as preventing it being a stepping stone for MacArthur back towards Japan.
Hmm. Well, the response in Darwin and, I suppose, Singapore, not really our finest hours, were they?
No, in neither case did we do that well. But that's war. War is a fairly brutalising event, and people don't handle it that well, not least of all because you don't know exactly what's going to happen until it does happen. But the response in Darwin particularly was probably no different from a response anywhere else in the world to that sort of thing. People, the civilians, hot-footed out of the area. They're not able to defend themselves against an army. So perhaps our reaction there, as one of the historians, war historians, has said, is not so much that we were worse than anyone else. It was a realisation that we were no better in our response. And the worst part was the way the military, who were stationed in the Northern Territory, responded, and that was fairly disgraceful. Probably we wouldn't have had our best military there. In fact, we didn't. Our best military was over fighting in the Middle East to save England.
You mentioned a bit earlier the fall of Singapore, and I think people might have heard of Force Z in Singapore, but that was never going to save Australia, was it?
I think it had some success and some failure, as these things always do, but they weren't present in the defence. What was there? Well, there was Force Z. I thought you were talking about the sabotage unit. Force Z was what the garrison there was called, but it was under-resourced, it was poorly led, it was old-fashioned in its ideas, and against a well-drilled, experienced military force like the Japanese, like Yamashita had, he was driving down Malaya, it was always going to end up the way it did.
There was a lot of that thinking, wasn't there, that the physical characteristics of the Japanese wouldn't enable them to really put on a battle, and they were doing things like going on push bikes instead of vehicles and tanks and things. A bit of a sort of a superiority complex among the Westerners.
Absolutely. They weren't even good at sport.
Yeah, so how could they run a war?
Exactly. Yes, I'm sure what the connection is, but to Australians it's a connection.
John Curtin, in his famous New Year's Day speech, talked about looking to America. It wasn't well received, though, in either the US or the UK, was it?
Well, the US, I think, was probably worried about, first of all, the impact it might have on the alliance and the sort of limitations of the alliance between Britain and subjects. Britain had sort of sold to the US that all of the Commonwealth countries would fall into step, and that suggested that may not be the case, which just destabilizes the alliance there a little. There might have been some attempt to do what Churchill would like them to do, namely to say this is terrible to hose it down. Certainly the response from Britain was not good, and the response from conservative elements in Australia, which was still very sort of God-king country, was not strong. And it was sort of seized and probably blown up more than Curtin intended it. But certainly he saw America as being more able to assist Australia in its hour of need, as he saw it, than Britain has already let us down on Singapore. In fact, no, they hadn't let us down then on Singapore, but there were doubts about Singapore, which became manifest.
Yes. And we're speaking today with Craig Colley, who is the author of a new book called On Our Doorstep, When Australia Faced the Threat of Invasion by the Japanese. Craig, we've reached the part of the program where we ask our guests if they'd like to pick a song for the show. Have you picked one for us?
I have. I've picked Mary Ann by The Temptations. Why do I like that, you probably ask. It's a romantic song. It's a sort of almost excessively romantic song. And there's a romantic streak in me. but I've gone for the romantic for today's exercise.
And that was Mary Ann by The Temptations, as chosen for us today by our special guest Craig Colley, who is the author of a new book called On Our Doorstep, When Australia Faced the Threat of Invasion by the Japanese. So, Craig, we've talked about the fall of Singapore. That was really a bit of a bluff by the Japanese, wasn't it? Because they were in fact outnumbered, and really, if they hadn't surrendered, if the British hadn't surrendered, probably the Japanese would have shortly after.
They certainly would have pulled out. They wouldn't have surrendered. They just would have backed off. They were running out of ammunition, and they were concerned that Britain might be bringing supplies and reinforcements by sea. So they're keeping an eye on whether that was approaching, and tried to bluff the defenders into giving up. They realised that they were sort of backing off. This is the defence, but they weren't backing off far enough. And in one instance, Yamashita ordered his soldiers to not use bullets but use bayonets in their attack. Bayonets being a resource you can keep using, bullets you can't.
And there was that very controversial episode where the Australian commander, Gordon Bennett, actually fled Singapore and came back to Australia. How was that generally received?
It had a mixed reception. His own soldiers seemed to have accepted it, certainly by the time they got back from POW camp, which he avoided, but they didn't, seemed to have accepted his explanation, which was he had to come back and advise how to fight the Japanese. I'm not sure that he demonstrated that much expertise in that, and it's hard to avoid the conclusion that he was basically looking after his own interests and not at those of his soldiers, but they don't seem to have seen it that way. Certainly he was heavily criticised in Australia and by the military for, as they saw it, deserting his own men, letting them go into the POW camp, but managing to avoid it himself. And I must admit, I'm a little bit inclined to that view.
Was there any consideration of a Dunkirk-type rescue from Singapore to get them back to Australia?
There was a sort of protest that it should have been like Dunkirk, but there are major differences between Dunkirk and Singapore. The distance across the English Channel is considerably shorter than the distance from Singapore to Australia. The planes that the British put out in Singapore were obsolete and next to useless and mostly had been shot down. So it was a land fight where only the Japanese had the support on air and sea. And whereas you could run small boats across the English Channel, it's not so easy to run them across from, say, Darwin to Singapore. The circumstances were quite different, and there was certainly a lot of rumbling at the time that the English did Dunkirk but didn't do the same thing at Singapore.
So then there was the attack on Darwin, and in fact it wasn't just Darwin, it extended really across northern Australia. So you had Broome, you had Katherine, you had Townsville. Why were the Japanese attacking these centres in Australia?
I think to rattle our cage, mostly. They were always raids. Some of them would be targeted raids against military targets, and most of them were probably those who were airfields. But airfields are near cities, so in towns, so they get their collateral damage as well. Apart from Darwin, they were just minor raids, and none of them involved an attempt at an invasion landing. The assumption that the fleet that was held up in the Battle of Coral Sea was an invasion attempt on Australia is there's no evidence for that. They were wanting to land and take Port Moresby, not as a staging point to invade Australia, but for the counter-offensive that clearly MacArthur was planning, seeing he had been moved to Australia, was not in a position to take Rabaul, where the Japanese had set up a large naval base.
Look, you mentioned MacArthur then, and I'm sure there must have been a lot of relief in Australia when he was appointed to take command of the Pacific. But I think, in your words, he was unorthodox.
Huge relief in excess of what MacArthur's talents and skills, but he served his purpose. He mobilised people under the belief He had political clout in America. He was loathed by his own soldiers, but adored by the Australians, and particularly the Australian public, because sort of seeing ourselves as the target of Japanese invasion intentions, he was the key with the resources he could bring from America to preventing that. And that was the reason for encouraging the stationing of MacArthur in Australia. The Americans, of course, didn't do it to save Australia. They did it because it was the best base to run their counteroffensive against Japan. They, in fact, ran it in two ways, although we only noticed the MacArthur one. They also ran under Admiral Nimitz a line of invasion up from Guadalcanal through the islands, island hopping towards Japan. So, which the Japanese didn't work out at the in their early days either.
Yes, we just talked about there was relief in Australian quarters at MacArthur arriving, but there was also some resentment towards the great numbers of Americans suddenly flooding into the country among the Australians, wasn't there?
Yes, there was a bit of cultural shock there. Some welcomed it. There are always, whenever modernity arrives on anyone's shores, there are people who are going to react against it, who liked the old ways. An American sort of culture represents modernity, and to some people then and even now, it represents a sort of more crass form of modernity. But also, they took over things. And Townsville was the prime example where they took over. In fact, it was both militaries, but the Americans were more noticeable because they are more noticeable. And the Townsville civilians sort of resented being sort of squeezed out of their own town a bit and out of the facilities. And all of the facilities that the American military provided for its soldiers were sort of luxurious and superior to the Australians, who have to go down to the wet canteen with an empty jam tin to get it filled up. And things like that, the differences in pay levels were great. Americans and also the fact that Americans look glamorous, so there was a suspicion that they were attracting our women, and they were, because they were attractive. Well, they certainly were in the first instance. I think it pulled a bit after time. They sort of started to come over as a bit superficial, but certainly in the early days, they looked glamorous in a time when there wasn't much glamour.
Now, MacArthur was also caught up in this story of what was called the Brisbane Line. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that.
It was a beat-up sort of political opportunism by Eddie Ward, who could see political advantage in damning the previous Conservative government with it. It was a contingency that wasn't called the Brisbane Line. That was a phrase that MacArthur invented and claimed it had been used all the time. In fact, he invented it because he wanted to promote himself as the person who overruled it. It was a contingency if, despite our best efforts, Japan do land an invasion force and establishes a toehold in the north, what is our priority? And our priority is to ensure that they don't get to be able to destroy our industrial capacity. And that's all concentrated in Southeast Australia. If they land, then if they can be contained in the north, we've still got a chance of pushing them back out, given that Northern Australia is not a particularly friendly place to be invading. It no resources, it's difficult, and there seems to be an assumption that somehow, whereas we struggled to get trucks across the Northern Australia, the Japanese could somehow manage to do that. Hard to see why. To invade Australia and to be holding Northern Australia is not a very strong toehold. So you've got a chance of pushing them back out again. So that it was a contingency. What do we do if not a line above which nothing matters, which is the way Ward first presented it, and then MacArthur picked up and said, I've changed all this. He didn't. It had already been changed by Blamey and the Australian Army.
Now, a lot of people have heard about Japanese banknotes being printed, and there was supposedly a map, a Japanese invasion map. The big question, were the Japanese intending to invade Australia in your mind?
No, there's no evidence to support it. The invasion currency didn't specify it was Australian currency, just had British currency, and they did use their British denominations, shillings and pounds. They did use that in the captured areas of New Guinea, New Britain. There's no reason to think it was done for Australia or New Zealand, because there was nothing on the notes to suggest that it was used in the places they had captured where the currency was in pounds, shillings and pence. So the bank notes aren't evidence of an intention to invade Australia. The map was supplied by Chinese naval intelligence, and probably was supplied not to pretend it was an invasion map, but because it had notations on it in what was assumed by some people to be Japanese lettering, but is actually Chinese, and English translations. It's Chinese speculation of what the Japanese might be intending, which is not quite the same as the Japanese telling us what they are intending. It's hard to see why, if it was a Japanese planning map, why they would put English translations on it, and it's certainly hard to see why they would label it in Chinese instead of Japanese, even though the older form of Japanese lettering is the same as Chinese characters, but their syntax of their construction is quite different.
Of course, it's easier for us now to look back at what was very real to Australians then. And you include a story of parents planning to kill their children in the event of Japanese. And I'm sure, I know in my own family there was talk of partners killing each other if the Japanese invaded.
And particularly daughters.
Yes. So, you know, it certainly was very real. And look, your book is a wonderful exposition of exactly what was going on at a fascinating time in Australian history that more people should be aware of.
And an insight into the nature of Australian people, I think.
Yes.
How unique this is.
Yes, definitely. And I'd just like to give a special thank you to our guest, Craig Colley. Craig, thank you very much for being a guest on Dad's on the Air.
Thank you, Bill. That was the most enjoyable.
Oh, that's great. And don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show or any of our shows, go to your favourite podcast app or our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.